So hello, everyone, and welcome back to Blended. Last month, my guests and I talk about preference versus bias. We had some really interesting discussions on the difference between the two, how you can support preference without enabling bias, and why, as part of our individual growth, we should be looking within ourselves and evaluating the preferences we hold and why we hold them. It was a great discussion, but we can only cover so much in just one episode. And I still have a lot of thoughts. So today we're continuing that discussion and diving deeper into what we need to know about bias. Where does it come from? How do we learn about it? How do we handle it? And where do workplaces fit in? And most importantly, how do we call it out? Not just in others, but also in ourselves. So welcome to Shimon, Pooja, Margot, Mary, who are going to share their thoughts and experiences with us today. Let's get started and get to know them. So can each of you tell me who you are, what you do, and how you identify? So I'm going to start with you, Shimon.
Hey, everyone. Yeah, thanks for the introduction and thanks for the topic and bringing me on board, Sarah. So a little bit about myself. I am in my mid-career navigating through the beautiful and chaotic field of supply chain. I am currently working as a consulting supply chain technical project manager for a large consumer electronics company based out of California. So I am based out of California, but I'm originally from India. I am an Indian. And I identify myself with the pronouns she and her.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and having some courage. We're going to have a great discussion today. Margot, can you go next? Tell us who you are, what you do, and how you identify.
Absolutely. My name is Margot Goodson. I'm the head of North America Diversity and Inclusion here at SAP. I am a mother, a wife, a team ministry leader, an advocate in my community, and I have my passion as my profession, leading diversity, equity, inclusion. I have three beautiful children, 17, 25, and 26, and I'm a proud mom of three. So excited to be here because bias and preference are things that we encounter every day, and I'm looking forward to a wonderful conversation because in my identity, both personally and professionally, these things intersect.
Yes, absolutely. And the last discussion really showed that. And really, like, how do we think about preference versus bias? I'm glad that you're here. Thank you so much for making the time. All right, Mary, you're up next.
Hi, everyone. First of all, thank you so much, Sarah, for having me. And I'm excited for our discussion. So my name is Mary Madette Mendoza. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a vocal coach. I am the founder of Resilient Musicians Academy, where I help young students find their voices and become skilled musicians, confident performers, and most of all, resilient individuals. In saying that, I am a mental health advocate. I have lived experience with anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. And one of my missions is to help inspire youth in finding their own emotional resilience through creative outlets. My pronouns are she and her. I am Filipino-Canadian. I moved to Canada when I was 1 year old.
Nice. And I'm so glad you're here. And you don't just teach younger people, you teach people like me because you're my same teacher. And we get together every Tuesday and it's so much fun and you make such a big difference. So I'm so glad you're here to share your story as well. Thank you. So Pooja, last but not least, tell us who you are and what you do and how you identify.
So I'm Pooja Brown, South Asian immigrant living in California. My pronouns are she and her. I'm like all of us, way too busy. I'm a tech and a product leader and an entrepreneur, along with trying to build awesome things. I'm really passionate about logistics and supply chain technology. Oh, and you know, I'm also a mom with two awesome and exhausting girls, a five-year-old and a nine-year-old who's basically going on to 13. And Sarah, like, you know, thanks for having me in this morning. I'm really, really excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here. And it's so funny that you say that there's 9 going on 13. I'm sure there's people in the audience that can probably relate to that as well. So this is going to be a lot of fun. Let's kick it off with a few little conversation starters. So where do you think bias comes from? I mean, we talk about bias and we kind of talk about it being human nature. Is that really it? Like, just does it just come within our DNA, or is this something that is learned behavior from a long time ago? Margo, I'm going to start with you because you're the DEI guru here on the panel. So tell us, where does this come from?
Well, I will first say that as a Black female in my 50s, identifying she, her, I thought it came from just my specific identity towards or against just one group. And what I've learned is that if you have a brain, you have bias. And that the rate of information that comes to us in any given moment is essentially shortchanged by these preconceived notions that we make decisions very quickly. And it's a wonder, because even as we're sitting here talking, we may be experiencing other senses around visually seeing things or hearing things audibly or experiencing sensations and touch and such. And so with that, the bias creeps in. We have to go for what we know, what we've become familiar with, what our lived experiences are. So I do feel like to some extent, it is just it in that you have a brain, you have bias, but bias isn't always bad. That's another learning that I've had in D&I. It could be towards something just as well as against something. There are a myriad of biases that we explore. And I learned that through that affinity bias is sometimes a good thing, right? The attention bias and all the things we talked about being moms, people have teachers' pets or favorites and children, et cetera. So I simply have embraced that bias is natural and that there are things that we can do to call people in, not out, be a coaching culture, not a cancel culture, but to understand that with it, none of us are exempt from the impacts of bias or actually practicing various forms of bias.
Yeah. And like, we're all kind of responsible for it.
Absolutely.
Right? It touches everybody, but you bring up a good point. It's not necessarily all bad. And this is one of the things that came up in the last episode when we were talking about preference versus bias, is that there is such a negative connotation around this one word.
Right.
And it doesn't always have to be negative. But the problem with changing the word is then you just end up in confusion and nobody knows what's going on. And then everybody retreats and doesn't want to do anything about it. So
you don't have to change it, but you do have to add to it, like that unconscious and implicit and those things that you get the learning of it with the attitudes and stereotypes and such.
We're going to get to those too, right? Because I want to hear all about those. So Pooja, you're nodding your head. And I did tell you, if you were nodding your head, I was going
to
bring you into the conversation.
I have to remember
and nobody
that.
Can
I'm
see
Indian.
This.
I nod a lot of my head. Part of how I communicate to the world.
So what do you think about bias?
I disagree.
Yes.
Well, no, I think, you know, I was actually agreeing entirely, Margaret, to what you're saying, right? Because I think, you know, again, like it's if you have a brain, you have a bias, right? Because this is the skill you learn is how to pattern match. And so you don't get stuck with analysis paralysis with every decision, right? So to some extent, you do need that skill. And, you know, as millions of decisions are coming through your day, you're constantly evaluating them and pattern matching. But the thing that, you know, I look at these as basically shortcuts that drive your behavior. But the thing that, again, that I know, you know, we'll talk more about is to watch out for is that what these shortcuts, what sort of local optimal that these shortcuts are trying to drive you versus a larger objective, right? And that could be as simple as, you know, running a successful business or trying to create a fair and working environment. And sometimes these shortcuts need to be trained out of this local orbit that they're trying to optimize for. So it was actually a nod to Margaret, what you're saying. And because I do think that it's a lot of it is training if you're around what you signals you're picking up from your environment.
Yeah. Well, and being aware of it and being aware that you have to train yourself, because most people just aren't aware of the bias that they carry. Mary, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with our upbringing and just the people we are surrounded by. And I think the first people that really influence our bias is our family, because we're with them 24/7. And I also thought about how I think it's possible that even the music we listen to or the TV shows that we watch can influence the way we view the world. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but I think that just being around or absorbing whatever energy is around us can really affect the way we think and the way we feel about certain things.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, it depends who you hang out with, what you read, what you listen to, what you watch. It all really has an influence as to how you move through your day to day. Right. And so that is so important. And one of the things, I'm listening to Grant Cardone's like 10X book. Okay. And he talks about success. And it's really a mindset shift. A lot of people have a bias towards people who have success and have a lot of money and think that they're not doing enough and, you know, they need to do more, et cetera, et cetera. But the way he frames success is that it's a duty, obligation, and responsibility. Because if I'm doing that, then I can actually showcase what is possible to other people. And so I just wanted to showcase the bias that we have towards success, but then what a little mindset shift can actually do to bring that forward and be like, well, no, wait a second. I have to do this because this is how I'm going to show up in the world and how I'm going to be able to make a difference. Shimon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's quite a few great points here, Sarah. Like, you know, the last point that you just made is more of bias for action, mm-hmm. right? And that is such an important thing. But, you know, as Margaret was saying, like, when you say bias, it was a very interesting perspective. And for me, when I talk about bias, and like Mary said, it's some thoughts that's embedded from within us because of our, you know, cultural upbringing, our surrounding. And sometimes it just gets stuck as an opinion. And I think it takes a lot of learning as well as unlearning, you know, as you grow, as you move to different countries, as you meet people of different ethnicity, and everyone's different, but it's a perspective. And sometimes it's, you have to challenge your bias. You have to kind of take a step back and question it. But sometimes, you know, bias is not always a wrong thing. Like, bias for action is an amazing thing if you're able to take it forward in that direction. Yeah.
So you just said a very interesting thing. Bias is opinion or perspective. I have never really heard the two of those together. What do we think about that? Because bias really is, I think, after hearing that, is perspective and opinion. What do you think, Margo? I know you got something to say.
I somewhat agree, and I term it a little bit differently, but it's similar. Learned attitudes and stereotypes, because those are the things that do shape your perspective, right? And the socialization agents that are part of the way it comes to us. It was mentioned family, it was mentioned media. We teach an intentional inclusion session here at SAP, and we talk about socialization agents being family, early education, peers, workplace, religion, government, and media. And some of that has already been touched on, the people you're around, the things you listen to. It does shape your perspective, but how does it come to you? It's learned. What is it? Your attitudes, your perspectives are the ways that you engage across the stereotypes and biases. Some will create positive action. Some will create sometimes retreat. Some people will feel that they're going to be called out for their perspectives versus called in to participate and be coached into the way that we can make positive change. Mm. And let's face it, we all are unique in our identities, and we all possess multiple diversity dimensions. Therefore, the way we interact is going to create those opportunities to embrace differences, explain and be part of biases, both positively and negatively, for something, against something, and use that as protection mechanisms almost in the way we navigate society.
So you bring up a really good point there, because, and Pooja, I'll get to you in just one second. So leaning into bias, mm-hmm. right? We got to take this negative connotation, like we talked about earlier. We have to lean into bias, good, bad, ugly, whatever that is. We can't learn from it unless we lean into it. And we're truthful about what that bias is for ourselves. The other part of this is how we were brought up and which age bracket we're in. Because at the end of the day, the world is evolving with us. Mm-hmm. And so, Margo, when you and I were younger, right? I feel like we've been through a lot of different things than maybe Pooja, Shimon, and Mary, because I think they're younger, or they're at least younger than me. And the way you were brought up, where I was brought up, the world is still evolving and we're still trying to figure things out. And so there's no real like one size fits all here.
Right.
And I think we have to remember that, right? I think it's progress over perfection. And we get caught too much into the perfection of us being, no, I don't have any bias. And if I do, I don't know what to do about it. So I'm just going to ignore it.
Yeah.
Right.
But look, we've got a positive vibe of bias happening amongst us currently because there's an affinity or an association by us all being gender female.
Well, that's true. That is true. I will say though, so for this blended episode, I have to get five people every single episode or up to five people. And women are so much better at raising their hand and saying, yes, I want to talk about this topic. It's very difficult to get a man on this podcast.
And that's okay because we still bring very unique perspectives. We are intersectional, multidimensional in our identities. So we have a mix of race and ethnicity. We have a mix of generations. We have a mix of religion and education and and industry and things like that. So you do still bring the variety of lenses for which to explore bias.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. All right, Pooja.
Well, I'm catching my train because this is such a fascinating thought process, right? But the thing that I was leaning on was, you're right, is that like identifying bias is a continuous process, right? Because the people, the interaction, the time, the gender, like things are constantly changing. And where I feel like the most work has to happen is, you know, for each one of us is, how do you surround yourself with actual real feedback where, you know, you have a chance to understand how your actions are sort of impacting the rest, right? Mm-hmm. So like, if you think about like, you know, how does a system learn? A system learns through feedback, but you have to trust the people who are giving you that feedback, and you need to surround yourself with actual data. Right. So like, you know, whenever I've run like large engineering teams, right. And like, if diversity and inclusion is an important tenet, like, how do you measure that? Right. Mm-hmm. You measure that through looking at how many people were hired last year, how many people were promoted last year. Right. If you were in a business where you want your workforce to represent the customers, like, how are you looking at that? And I feel like that changes every, you know, almost all the time. So if you really care about, I don't know if you want to evict bias, because I don't think like that's a real term. Like, how do you evict bias, right? But how do you sort of adapt or train your bias to the surroundings is a continuous process. And it takes hard work to keep doing that.
And that's a really good point. And I am going to ask a really hard question in a minute, but I want to give Shimon and Mary an opportunity to jump in on here because there's a lot to unpack here. Shimon, do you want to start?
Yeah, I'm really loving the interesting, you know, opinions that we have here, I think, because I do feel that sometimes one size does not fit all. But I also like to, I think it's about the ability to be open-minded. You know, when someone is biased and throws out a very opinionated statement, there is a lot going on as to where the statement is coming up from, right? And like Pooja said, it is an ongoing journey. And the more we engage in it and take it as a feedback process for oneself, right, to kind of grow, to kind of involve other people in the community and to kind of acknowledge the diverse perspective. And I guess that's how we're really contributing to creating a more inclusive and a diverse community, as well as the atmosphere that one would cultivate for ourselves and the others.
Mm-hmm. Such a great point. And it goes right into the question I'm going to ask, but I'm going to give Mary an opportunity to jump in here first.
Yeah, I agree with everybody. And I think where how we can identify bias in ourselves is constantly asking questions to ourselves. Is this fair? Like, just being curious about every thought we have, about every reaction we feel about a certain situation. One thing that has really helped me a lot on a personal level is going to therapy. And my therapist has really helped me train my mind to question everything that I feel and everything that I think and every experience that I have in my life to question myself and ask, well, why do I think that way? Or why do I feel that way about that particular person? Or why do I think that way about that particular event? So I think it's really important to have that person, whether it's a therapist or just, or even a coworker, someone who you can trust to kind of feed off your thoughts with and get a different perspective.
Yeah, it's such a good point because, so we just did a poll and I think 50% of people said that they were hesitant to ask for a mental day off, a mental health day off. And the reason why I bring that up is because we all need to be able to have the space to be able to go and do the work that we need to be able to do on ourselves. And it's really important that we feel safe and that we have the opportunity in a workplace to ask for a mental health day. And maybe that includes a therapist appointment. Maybe.
And maybe
the company, sorry, go ahead.
No. Continue. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Maybe it means that the company needs to offer some therapy options as well, because that creates an environment where people are used to sharing, being authentic, being vulnerable, but then also understanding more about themselves. And it makes a healthier work environment. Margo, what were you going to say?
I was going to say similar, because we do offer a mental health series of days, but the underlying point that comes from what Mary said and the need for mental health and understanding and awareness of our own brains is empathy. Mm-hmm. When you have empathy for others, and it increases your understanding and awareness of what's happening with them as well as yourself, that uncovers and helps you discover which types of biases might be at play. Because once you're empathetic and not sympathetic, but you're trying to increase your understanding, awareness, and partnership with that person, then you're seeing it through the lens that they're experiencing it. And you realize sometimes where perhaps something you said or did contributed to it. So empathy is a point that I think is super duper important when understanding bias and the impact of it, when understanding the reason and value of therapy and mental health awareness. Mental health is a state that you want to keep in a positive frame, not a negative frame. And so that all contributes to it collectively.
Yeah. And I think the faster we understand that, or maybe even organizations understand that, the faster we can start learning about ourselves and maybe understanding bias. Now, I have a really difficult question. The concept of DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, is that biased?
Not for me in the way that I lead it, because it's diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's equity for all at the end of the day, inclusion for those who traditionally, systemically, generationally haven't been included, and then the representation. To me, diversity is a fact. That's already inherent. Even in a homogeneous set that's gender-based, we're diverse in other ways. We're 100,000 plus colleagues at SAP, for example. So we're inherently diverse because of all the five generations, all the ethnicities, all the things. But inclusion is a behavior. Equity is a systemic change of processes and procedures. So for me, diversity transcends people into processes, programs, operations. Equity is for all. Doesn't mean equal. It means equitable. It means remove the barriers that are in the way to enable all of us to thrive right where we are. And inclusion is important because even if someone who is deemed a majority population that may have a little bit more privilege and power in one sense may not have it in another sense. And they would want to be included when Bob had the afternoon of golf and they weren't invited and they found out they weren't invited. They want to be included too when Sally is doing something. And we all have that innate human desire to be included. Mm-hmm. I don't care what your identity or demographic is. So I don't see that as bias. I see it as opportunistic to ensure that everyone understands the various diversity dimensions in which we collectively and individually operate, so that we can ensure that the value of the belonging, the behavior of being inclusive, the outcomes of being equitable enhance the value of the diversity.
Thank you for sharing that. And the reason why I asked that question is because some people are biased within diversity, equity, and inclusion. They can be. And some people think that people are, right? You've got, you know, some white men who think about the concept and what we discuss about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they don't feel included. And so that's why I was asking. That's I knew it was going to be a hard question.
Point. Yeah. No, it's a fair point. And we try to include them in various ways. Leverage that power and privilege. Hey, help with this. Let us help you to explore the different things. And many of them will say things like, well, of course, I believe in gender equity. I've got two daughters. I'm like, yeah, but what about your wife and your mom and your sister?
Yes. Did you forget them? Hey, they say that all the time. Yes. My daughters, but then they don't say wife. Yes.
So I think that we all, I think when we take a step back and remove the defense mechanisms and understand where and how we all fit into it, it really isn't about mitigating somebody else's existence. It's helping us to all thrive and grow and prosper together.
But I throw that out because people in diversity, equity, inclusion, doing the work and, you know, putting so much amazing energy, we just also want to make sure that we're not making decisions and doing things out of bias for that. Pooja, Shimon, Mary, I know it's a difficult question. Anybody want to weigh in here?
Yeah, maybe I can throw in a point, right? I feel it's doing everything to kind of break that barrier on bias. In a way, it's trying to, you know, as Margaret said, to bring in more equity and kind of get everyone up to the same part. Maybe, you know, at some point in time when we feel that, okay, we've reached a point where there's not this much bias, then you wouldn't really, you know, kind of just highlight a certain sect as being diverse and just kind of allocate a reservation system, you know, when we compare it to the caste system in India and things like that. So it takes a lot of time. It takes generations together to kind of, some, you know, when the underprivileged have gone through certain repercussions of how the society was, it kind of requires a little bit of handholding to get them on par with where the society is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't really think it's a biased thing.
Well, and one example I think was shared in one of my first episodes of Blended was forms that only say, I think, was it Asian, right? And so when there's a form that only says Asian and you're not able to actually self-identify from the country that your origin is from, you know, you feel completely excluded. But that's a bias on the part of the person that put together that form.
Right, right.
Right. And we have to be conscious of those things. And we have to call those out, right? We're going to be talking about calling that out in a minute. Absolutely. Pooja, did you want to add anything?
No, I think, I mean, you know, and you have to believe that bias exists everywhere, right? It's just, it is no matter what, it's not really a diversity thing. It's not really because I'm brown versus South Asian, et cetera. It exists everywhere, right? And then, you know, when you look at that and like the thing that comes to my mind always is like, where, you know, the fact that, you know, Mary said that she goes to therapy or, you know, the first step I feel in making it an inclusive place is sort of talking about your own bias and what you're doing to counter that.
Yeah. Right? The leader is giving an example, right?
Exactly,
like actually sharing, like, you know, I realize that my bias is this, and this is what I'm doing to work on it.
And I just feel like that is such a critical first step for it to be a safe environment. Right. And it's, you know, and to me, like at work, if somebody says that they're doing this to work on a bias that they know that they have, that itself is a turning point for me to do something about that, right? And the fact that you said like the mental health day, right? Like for a while, that was a bias to even ask for it, right? But then like when people started saying that I'm taking a mental health day or companies started making it, you know, take 5 mental health days, it suddenly became a safe space for anybody to operate in it. So, you know, to your original question, like, I don't think DEI is a bias itself, right? But I think it needs to be more inclusive of everybody. And by sharing your stories, people want to be a part of it then. That's why, like, I want more men in these conversations, right? Because I'm sure they feel excluded in various things and they don't have a first step to get into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The biggest workplace bias, I don't care if you have a DEI program or not, I don't care if you're talking male or female, is having a go-to person.
What do you mean by that? Please share.
I always go to Sarah when I have a project. She's so reliable. She's going to make me look good. This is going to work out. She's my lead. And without fail, no matter what, I'm going to ask Sarah to lead it. Mm-hmm. Well, what if Pooja or Mary has an idea? What if they would like to lead it this time? You don't seem to rotate. So I guess we're just worthless here because, you know, Sarah's the woman, right? Or the man or whatever. People forget that. People forget that when you always go to the same individual, not only are you potentially burning them out and they probably don't want to say anything because they don't want to make it look like they don't want to be important to you.
Ungrateful.
Or, you know, ungrateful or anything like that. But the pressure could be drowning them. Maybe they do need to leave to go take care of themselves or someone else in their lives. And then the other teammates don't feel as valued because, okay, well, Sarah's got it. I guess that you just tell me what you need from me when you need it from me, right? And it diminishes the power of the team. It diminishes the innovation, the agility, and the benefits of having a diverse team to increase your outcomes because you're not actually leveraging that diversity. It could be an all-male team, but if they bring different perspectives of industry, of generations, of academic, of lived experiences, you want the power of those things. But if you always go to that same person or that same one or two people, and you have a larger team, having a go-to person is a form of bias. It's an association bias that that person possesses the intellect and the network and ability to perform greater than others. And that association bias to that person is what's going to tear down the rest of the team potentially because of the way that we're engaging. And that can be unconscious sometimes, subconscious, implicit, but it's huge in the workplace. And it does also play out in family dynamics with children and in the classroom with teachers and quote unquote teachers' pets and things like that. People don't often think about the impact it's having on everyone else. They just think about the elevation that they're given that one or two individuals.
Yeah, and I want to come back to you about the different types of bias, because I think there's a long list that we can kind of go through. But going back to Pooja and Shimon, based on what Margot has just talked about, have you experienced any of that in your career? And the first thing that I went to was, what are some of the excuses that were given to deflect from it being bias? Because if you think about it, right, if you go to somebody and say, you always go to this person, and that's a bias, whether you say bias, the word bias or not or whatever, there's probably going to be some excuses made as to why they always go to that person. They're more reliable. I can rely on them. They work till 8 o'clock at night, right? Whatever it is, they're not going to come out and be like, yes, that is my bias. You know, I'm sorry. Maybe they will, but most probably won't. And they'll have excuses. Have you experienced that in your career, Shimon or Pooja?
I can go for it. It's interesting, you know, as you were saying that, the thought that came to my mind was actually labeling and titles are a way to cluster all those excuses. So yeah, I don't know, you know, I read the John Altspaugh a lot, and you know, he talks a lot about, you know, senior engineers or, you know, principal engineers versus just the mature, like engineers who can take on a hard problem and go run with it. Right. And, you know, you can be a senior engineer, but is that the reason to always go to that person to get something done? Right. Or are they traits that you're looking for that you might actually find beyond that labeled senior engineer? Right. So I see that in technology all the time. And, you know, and it's really hard to break out of that association or labeling bias, if anything. Right. Because because senior is a shortcut in my mind to say reliable, we'll get it done, all of that. Right. And they on their end, they're also expecting hard problems to be given to them. Right. And now suddenly you've now limited the, you know, either diversity or the opportunity for somebody else who might not be labeled senior, but could also maybe outperform or, you know, show a different light on a problem. So like, I think the labeling is another type of bias that we that we as humans are starting to train ourselves on.
Well, and I think titles.
Titles is a label.
Titles almost. Because I think about it and I think about these groups that are only for the C-suite. And then I think about, you know, conferences and they only ask people with senior titles potentially because that's what they feel that they have to have on the stage when there is somebody else who could probably bring and shed so much more light on that particular topic that doesn't necessarily have a senior leadership title. So that bias is actually, prominent in industry in a variety of ways. And maybe that's something that we have to rethink. Shimon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think I have a little bit of a conflicting opinion here, right? Sure. So I think the initial aspect of, you know, going to one person every single time is more of a preference more than a bias. Again, like if that's a positive preference or if this person, again, it depends on the role this person is playing, right? So when you work on strategy, it is very necessary that you get people of diverse background out there. You know, it could be a professional background where this person has worked on different kind of domains. It becomes very important that these people are included. But now let's say that, you know, I have like a consulting task that I need my Excel job to be done quickly. And you constantly keep going to this person. And well, I wouldn't really call that bias. It's more of a burnout on this person, right? Rather than giving them a preference because, you know, this person is pretty fast or pretty good at what they're doing. And you're kind of getting pulled into various different projects at the same time. And Sarah, to your point about, you know, certain, let's say, sessions or certain conversations reserved for certain set of people. But don't you think it kind of becomes vital to, you know, add some filters somewhere? It could be like a mid-career or senior career, or else, you know, it kind of, everyone gets lost. So maybe it's also a way to kind of set those filter so that, you know, you kind of bucket into different categories and you grow into it. But again, like title is just a title, right? Like my qualification could be way different from what my title is. And I could be able to contribute a lot more than what just my title holds. But again, like opportunities like this and the ability for one to seek out of just their title is where I think you grow out of it and, you know, get out of your comfort zone and try to reach out for more.
It's true, but I think that title gives us a label and it gives us excuses sometimes as to why we don't go to certain people, even though they could have all sorts of qualifications. And so I feel like it puts us in this box.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword.
It doesn't really showcase us as a full person or a full professional. You know what I mean?
True. Yeah, totally. I mean, that's the other edge of the sword, right? Like that's totally valid.
Yeah. All right, Margo. Talk to us about the different types of bias. Like, what are the things that we need to look out for?
Well, there's a whole litany of them, but if I were to say,
do you have it somewhere?
So we focus on six of them that we feel show up the most. Actually, top five. Affinity bias, which is more of a likeness towards that you have something similar, that whether that's gender, ethnicity, age group, whatever, that you draw towards people and you give preference towards people because of the likeness that's there. Mm-hmm. Association bias is more tied to that you are associating with a group of people, a particular characteristic or a performance trait, et cetera. You know, sometimes people will say, you know, oh, that group of people, those athletes, this, or those millennials, that, or, you know, things like that. So an association by
boomer.
Exactly.
That one drives me crazy.
that created some issues for sure. But, you know, attention bias is one that we talk about, where you're placing your attention. And that's where like the go-to can come into play and things like that. It could be as something as simple, you know, it's funny how people will get a new car. And now every time they turn a corner, they see somebody else with that car. And it's almost like no one had it before then. And now you're seeing it. They always did, but your attention is drawn to it. If someone makes a lot of mistakes, sometimes people will focus on just the mistakes or just the successes, right? And so even with that is where you're placing your attention. So it can be, you know, good and bad in that sense, in terms of where you're focusing the attention. So, but association, attention, affinity, halo effect. It's almost like not only is there someone who you go to often, but you elevate them. Oh, she's so smart and she's so this, she's so that. And I have to be careful in my own family. I do have three children, and one is super smart, always straight A's, magna cum laude out of college. The next one's very charismatic and athletic. And the last one is super creative. She's also smart, dancer. But it's known in our household that Nina's the queen bee of the kids, and Nina, and it's not intentional, and it's not even meant to be that way, but that's how they perceive it. And they've told me that, and I've had to call myself on it. And then I've seen it in the workplace. So that halo effect, and then workplace proximity bias is something that is super prevalent now with hybrid, but even before, if you saw somebody in the office at the cafeteria, something might strike up a conversation, an opportunity that just doesn't happen to present itself on that Zoom call. A call that is scheduled is scheduled. It typically has an agenda, a topic, and things that you cover. Those chance moments, I'm in our Atlanta office today. If I walk out and I walk into our RVP and we strike up a conversation that leads to some sort of benefit for me, for him, for the company, that's a chance moment that didn't happen. Many times you'll find companies like ours that are global, we have challenges with some teams being able to manage the time zones. So even workplace proximity bias right. with that. But most of us are on the East Coast, so we're scheduling it this time. But what about it's 5 a.m. on the West Coast, or it's, you know, nighttime in India, like those sorts of things. So affinity bias, association bias, attention bias, halo effect, and workplace proximity are the ones that we focus on when we're talking to our leadership teams. There are a good 10 more that we could dive into that D&I professionals focus on. But those five, we feel like, are the ones that are impacting us on a regular basis, such
and are
that
prevalent.
Make it part of our leadership training. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think if you want to look at more, go and do some research. I mean, everybody needs to do a little bit of the work. So go and do the research. Pooja, I'm going to go to you. And then I want to talk about experiences that everybody has had with bias. If you're open to sharing, no names, we don't need to do any of that, but we do need to give examples so that people can really understand situations, because if they have unconscious bias, they might not know that that was a situation that caused, you know, some turmoil. And I have some examples to share with that too. Pooja.
Trying to see if I can answer both questions, but maybe, maybe I'll first start with the biases that, you know, Margaret, you identified. I think the one that I find myself struggle a lot with is similarity bias, right? And like, I think it's a type of association, right? But especially as an immigrant, right? You sort of surround yourself with folks who look like you, who have similar traditions.
Affinity bias, that one, yeah.
Affinity, right? You create that home and that space of comfort. And it's really, you know, in my mind, like, how do you, you know, if you're an entrepreneur, if you're really, you know, if you're trying to sort of break out of the edge or the mold, that can result to unconscious bias, right? It's like, if I'm acting on my gut instincts, like, how would I break out of that gut and actually like do something that is, that maybe is groundbreaking, competitive with my customers or competitive with other products. So it's just, it just triggered in my head is that, you know, how much that sort of association or affinity bias creates this unconscious reactions or unconscious impact.
But can I just interrupt right there? The impact of this conversation, we've been talking for 45 minutes, has already had an impact on you in how you think about things and the way that you're doing things. And it's making you think about how you go through your day to day and how you make those decisions. And that is the reason for this podcast, right? Not only
is this a great point.
A way to be able for us to come together and sort of talk about, get out of our bubbles and talk about this in a way where we are all equal and, you know, we just bring our perspectives and talk authentically. And this is why we need conversations like this, because not only do each one of us need it, the audience needs it, right? The world kind of needs these conversations. So I just wanted to, you know, point that out, is that we're all evolving. We're all learning. it's a progress, right? It's not perfection. So do you have an example you want to share, Pooja?
Give me a minute to think more.
Okay, that's fine. I will start with mine. So two things came to mind, and then Mary, I'm going to go to you if you have one. So two things came to mind when Margot was talking. So I was talking to somebody the other day. They're an American that works for a Canadian company, and they were talking about how they scheduled meetings on American Thanksgiving and on some other holiday that the U.S. had for all the U.S. employees. And it was a very unconscious sort of bias thing, because most of the people that were creating the schedule are Canadian and weren't really thinking about the American holidays, right? But it really put the Americans in an awkward position, because they were like, no, this is a day off for me. I'm not going to make that meeting, right? Or somebody had to speak up and things like this. So that's just one very kind of small one. And then the other one, where you talked about the proximity to work bias, I was part of a conversation between two senior leaders, and they were like, unequivocally, if you do not work in the office, you will not get promoted. That's a bias, right? That should have been the point in the conversation when I turned to them and said, you think that's a little bit of bias and you might want to go and check it at the door? I didn't do that. I should have done it. I probably need some more training in how to broach the subject, which we will talk about. But those are just two examples that I will share of bias that has come up for me in probably the last.
And your second example, that existed pre-pandemic. Like, I think some people feel like now the hybrid and all that that has come in recent years has made some of that happen. But there are leaders who felt that way a long time ago, that they needed to see you to have them, and, you know, to know what you're doing and how they're evaluating you and whether or not you could be a leader and that you would lead it physically in person.
Well, and it's a much bigger topic. And we actually have a whole episode dedicated to that, I think, coming up in a couple months. So stay tuned for that one. Mary, do you have an example that you can share of some bias that maybe you experienced?
Yes, I have a very early example. Speaking to my point about how family, being with family 24/7, they're going to be the first people who are going to influence the way you think. And also connecting to the point that Margot mentioned about, I think it's called halo effect, where you highlighted the strengths of your different the strengths of your kids. And I couldn't help but remember a time when I was in high school and I was at home, and I have a big family, and we were all just hanging out. And then as soon as I sat on the couch, all of a sudden my whole family stood on the opposite side of the room looking at me. And I was just like, already I felt a contrast, like there's something, why am I the only one here and my whole family is over there standing and looking toward me? And I realized that they planned a surprise intervention.
Wow.
And what the intervention was about was they were comparing me to other people in my school, to my classmates, to my cousins, just pointing out how they are all outgoing, they're in romantic relationships, they socialize. And I was, especially back then, I was very shy, I was very quiet, I was an introvert. I enjoyed being in my room singing and listening to music. I was just I had a completely different personality than the others that they were comparing me to. And that, I think that was the first time that I experienced bias within my family. And so it made an impact in the way I thought and felt about myself, or the way I thought and felt about other people around me. And even just the physical setting of me on this side of the room and them on that side of the room, I already felt a sense of inequality.
Yeah.
And I mean, through, like I mentioned, I go to therapy, and therapy has really helped me a lot. Just to gain a better understanding of why they planned that intervention. And I started being more curious about, oh, well, you know, I wonder what is it about them or what they've gone through in their life that, that influenced the way they approached me in that situation. Mm. Ideally, as an introvert, I wouldn't have minded if it was a one-on-one conversation.
Right.
Rather than being blasted by everybody else in the room. I think that would have been a lot more effective for me and a lot more respectful.
Yeah.
But I don't, like, even though I share the story and I've talked about this story many times, I'm very comfortable with looking back and seeing what I've experienced. And I don't have any negative thoughts toward my family. I know that they were just trying their best. They were doing it out of love. It just wasn't in the way that I hoped that they would approach it. But we're all learning. We all have different experiences. We all have different ways of doing things. But it's also important for all of us to share our perspective and how we would approach certain things.
Yeah. And I'm sorry that you went through that, because that's really hard, especially with people that you feel are supposed to be your trusted sort of allies through this whole thing, right? Your family. But I'm so glad that you shared that, because I think one of the most dangerous bias, and I don't know if this is a thing, so Margo, correct me if I'm wrong, but comparison bias. I mean, if we think about social media and we think about how we compare ourselves to others. And so I think this is not only external, right? Because they had comparison bias kind of on your behalf, which is really strange. And I'm glad you've gotten, you know, over that and you're okay with your family and all that kind of stuff. But we do it also to ourselves, right? Comparison bias can be really, really damaging. Margo, is it a thing?
It is unofficially. It's not titled as such, but but it's the root of a lot of what we do under association bias and confirmation bias and attribute contrast effect and things like that. And we do, and we're very hard on ourselves. Sometimes we can see ourselves through the lens of others, and the biases play back to ourselves unintentionally because of.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the other part of that story is also the bias around how much we know about somebody else. Right? Because you are an introvert. And so the way that you would have liked that to be approached is a one-on-one. They were doing it out of love and how they would do it for themselves. But they didn't consider the bias around not actually understanding who you are as a person and what would actually work for you and translate better for you, right or wrong, whatever, right? And I think that also translates into the workplace, right? Sometimes, you know, you've got senior leaders that get together and confront an employee, or HR does this as well. And we got to check our biases at the door and really, I think, question how much we understand about the other person and maybe get to know them a little bit more so we know what approach is kind of the best. Shimon, do you have an example that you can share with us? Thank you, Mary.
Yeah, I think so, Sarah. Like, just the previous point that you made, right, was such a valid point. Like, how sometimes we seek like external validation or tend to compare ourselves with, you know, people on social media, people of our age who, you know, like sometimes certain milestones, like, you know, being married at a certain age or, you know, starting up a business within a certain timeline, it's considered like, you know, this is amazing. If not, maybe you've missed the mark. You've missed the boat has sailed. You know, I feel society often pushes us to chase external validation. You know, it could be like trying to be on a certain magazine cover or, you know, just trying to compare yourself with someone else to be there. I feel, and the other point that you made, like, for instance, like your family is probably coming out from a perspective that how they were probably treated or were told, and it's coming out of a place of love. But for you, it's almost comes as a place of shock because you're not used to understanding things that way. But I think one other, like, I I feel I have, you know, moving, being an immigrant, a person who has an accent and moving to a foreign country, there is, you know, like bias and experiences that you kind of face people and understand in your journey, right? And especially in supply chain, like you work with people who are on warehouse floors who are, you know, not very educated. And again, they come from their experiences, right? And all of us are really grew up with the experiences that we have been surrounded with. And there are people like, you know, like the VPs and people higher up in the rank who kind of ask questions, which is can be a little shocking to you, but you have to acknowledge the fact that they only know what they know. And it kind of becomes your responsibility to, you know, kind of be open-minded and answer that in a way that it kind of makes them think. Like, for instance, I still remember I was on a warehouse floor, you know, trying to do some auditing. And, you know, I tend to get very hands-on in my work. And there were certain people who asked me like, you know, oh, you're from India. And how do you speak English so well? And for me, I was a little taken aback because I hadn't really been asked that question in the sense that I think they were not aware that the mode of instruction in most Indian schools is English. You know, accent is different based on where you come from, but the mode of instruction is most certainly English. But I took a minute to kind of, you know, explain that, hey, you know, whatever subject we learn it in English. And they were just fascinated, you know, and it didn't really come from a very harmful place or more like a judgmental place. It really came from, you know, a curiosity place. And ever since then, you know, when I kind of get questions like that, I take it in a way that it's not defensive, but I take it as a responsibility to answer in a way that everyone's learning. Because I'm sure, like, you know, unconsciously, I may have asked someone, you know, a similar question. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a cyclical process, right? We learn. And, you know, curiosity is where you kind of tell people, you inform people with the knowledge that you have and you learn a bit from them.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that example. I think that's a really good example. We've talked a lot on this show about, you know, asking people where they're from because they have an accent. And sometimes it can get exhausting because you have to answer that question so many times throughout a certain period of time, you know, and how you ask it and all that kind of stuff makes a real difference. And I want to get to how do we confront bias in just a minute, because I think that's also an important part of this conversation. Pooja, do you have an example that you want to share?
Yeah. You know, by the way, the examples that you all shared were really great. And this, the one that I'll share is, I feel everyone's aware of it, but it did happen. And which is why, like, I was like, it's probably worth bringing up. And I went through this with both my pregnancies, right? And, you know, it was at work, you know, and, you know, I had decided my plan of how much time I'm going to take off. Right. And that was my plan, irrespective of the context of how much the company was going to give me was not right. And I felt like, you know, it is true that some of the opportunities that I had that I was going to get, I didn't get. Mm. Right. And that was sort of, and, you know, again, you know, there's so much material written about it. Women shouldn't check out before they check out, whatnot. Right. But it is a real thing. Right. And, you know, you yourself start questioning of like, okay, well, maybe I shouldn't be considered for this because who knows what the next 6 months are going to look like for me. Right. So like, there's not just sort of this, this bias around, you know, a situation, but it's also you're playing in your own psyche, mm-hmm. and your own ability to be able to do that. If everybody else thinks you're not going to be able to do it, most likely they're right. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just, you know, and I feel like, you know, I'm, you know, it's like how we're in such a different time and age now. Companies are so much liberal in terms of maternity leaves, et cetera, yet it still exists. Oh, and it was my own female boss who had gone through it herself, had worries about my ability to perform or what's going to happen with childcare once it happened, you know, and I'd spent so much time explaining how I got it covered. Like, they don't need to worry about it. I got it covered. I won the opportunity. And it's just, it's still a hard thing to work for.
Yeah. And it still exists. I mean, in the US, you get a lot less maternity leave than we get in Canada. I mean, Canada gets 12 to 18 months. I mean, you know, like, that's not even a question. They have to hold your position. Right. So it's also down to, you know, even the country that you live in and how they actually see, you know, motherhood and childcare and, you know, having a child when it comes to that organization. And but that's a mandate, I believe, from the Canadian government.
Yeah, that's a government level, regardless of your company's procedures and policies.
Yeah. So, Margot, last but not least, do you have an example you want to share?
I'm actually going to share two examples, and the reason, and I'll combine them, is because they're still very prevalent in my life. But it was learned early. You know, I attended Hampton University, which is a HBCU, historical Black college university. And a lot of companies do not feel that the education supposedly is the same level as the non-HBCUs, not even Ivy League, but just non-HBCUs. And so at the time, there was, and still is, a bias towards, against hiring from HBCUs. However, some corporations make a conscious decision that they will do it, but they're only going to do it at a limited level. So I benefited from the fact that Hampton University was one of few that the companies who had a bias against hiring from HBCUs felt that towards these four or five, Hampton, Howard, Spelman, Morehouse, that they would hire from there. So I was hired from there. I was one of 60 professionals, early talent, hired at Coopers and Lybrand then. So it wasn't even PwC yet. That's how I'm a little bit older. But one of 60 who were hired, who were of color. And it was disturbing to me, yet I figured, let me take this opportunity and going to do what I can do. So there was a bias against the types of schools we were, but then an affinity towards, or association, I should say, towards certain groups of the schools that I benefited from. And then contrastly, at Coopers and Lybrand at the time, the way I wore my hair mattered to them. And there were women of all colors who wear a bob hairstyle. And in the 80s, asymmetrical, one side being longer than the other, was very popular, was not unique to any one demographic. However, it was more prevalent in with Black women. And I was told by a partner to cut one side or grow the other. I wasn't going to the client with my hair like that. And I don't know when hair has anything to do with my ability to perform, but okay. And I went to the hairdresser every Friday. It was always neat, well done, polished, shiny, the whole nine, super straight with perms and chemicals in my hair, because I already knew at that time I could not wear natural hair. So I was doing what I thought was the quote unquote right thing, to have the straight hair, et cetera, that was more appreciated in corporate America. And I was wearing the blue, the brown, the black suits, but still it wasn't enough. Fast forward to today, and the Crown Act is not even passed in every state. And why do Black women need to have a legislative ability to wear, and not just women, men, hair a particular way, when any other ethnicity can color their hair, wear it long, short, or whatever? So today, though we are not on a video podcast, I sit with my natural curly hair that grows out of my head this way, and it's okay to wear it, yet I do still get certain looks. And there are times where I could wear my hair and have other hairstyles, synthetic hair added to mine, and it show up differently, or go to the hairdresser and get it pressed really hard and straight if that's more accepting for certain environments. So I bring that out because even in as head of North America, the diversity, equity, inclusion here at SAP, I see other companies, I see other people within this company, I see other entities who, one, still think inferiorly about HBCUs, and it's not the case. And many students now from other demographics do attend, and we have plenty of doctors, lawyers, and I'm a CPA, Six Sigma Green Belt certified diversity executive from an HBCU. Woo! That's still out there. And the hair aspect. And I can do my job whether I wear my hair bald or naturally curly out of it as it grows today, as I mentioned before you.
I am so sorry that you went through that. I mean, I remember, but this actually brings up a really good point in the fact that we can evolve, and we do evolve, and things change once we are able to talk about that bias. However, it doesn't change fast enough because, like you said, there's still legislature out there. Like,
Yeah. And well, it was something just passed a couple of years ago in California, because there were people who were fired from their job because of the way they wore their hair. There was a national case on the news
about
it not being able to wrestle because his hair, but the other person didn't have to cut his hair. And they cut his hair on the mat, on the floor in front of everybody, his locks, his dreadlocks. So there's a lot that comes with that in society, right? So some things are culturally and systemically and generationally perpetuated, and some things are changing. I'm here in Atlanta today, not because this is my home office for SAP, but because I am doing an HBCU event this evening. So corporate America is changing, society is changing. Yes, and you still had the abolishment of affirmative action as related to academia, and the fact that it's permeating into the corporate America. And it's not that people were being exclusive and trying to be inclusive. It was trying to increase the representation to reverse what was done without a name around it for years.
Right.
You had legacy preferences and things like that for schools and corporate places. But, you know, when it came to this, it needed to be, quote unquote, overturned. So that's my example that obviously, as we see in today's society, still exists in a number of different ways. Started for me in the corporate sense in 1990, and still is prevalent in 2024 at age 55. So
thank you. thank you for being vulnerable and sharing that example. Now, I want to be cognizant of the time, and so I want to talk about how do we confront bias. Right? Because obviously, if we start attacking everybody all the time, that's not very healthy. It's going to be toxic, right? But we do want to be able to bring it up. And I think a lot of people don't bring it up because they're just like, well, I don't really know how to do it. I don't know what to say. I'm going to say the wrong thing. So I'm going to retreat and not do anything, which is not what we want. So we do want people, and we also need to want people to let us know as well when we are showing bias too. So Margo, I'm going to end with you on this one because I think you've got a lot that you can share and maybe some action items that people can take. Pooja, I'm going to start with you. How do you think that we can confront bias respectfully?
I have a couple of thoughts on this. You know, I think at a high broad level, like I think, you know, there's a way to proactively do it and there's a way to reactively do it, right? From a proactive perspective, I think acknowledging its existence is a really important step, right? And I think, you know, when in a workplace and in any context, being able to acknowledge that bias exists and then being able to acknowledge its impacts. And, you know, what that means to you as a company, as an organization, that can be that is entirely what your mission is. But I think there has to be space for that. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think after that, I really do believe that, at least for me personally, this has had a lot of impact, is this sort of like going first approach. Right. Is like acknowledging that you have a bias, sharing it with folks and with the work that you did that it took to overcome it. And also like asking for others to help show me where there's bias that I actually can't see. Mm-hmm. That's really a critical space for people to just have this conversation and get feedback and provide feedback. Yeah. Like for me, like those are like the elements that help you combat bias, right? Per se, but again, it's hard work. It's a journey. But if you make space for it, you'll be able to do it.
So maybe including it in, when you review somebody's, you know, job performance.
Performance, yes.
Right? And then also if you do a review of somebody's leadership from the employee's standpoint as well, so that it comes from both sides and you're having a constructive conversation about that. I like that. Mary, what do you think? What do you think that we can do when bias is, you know, there? How do you sort of, and I don't want to use the word confront. I think that's so negative, right? But how do you sort of, you know, let somebody know that they're kind of in their bias?
Yeah, for me, especially as an introvert, I'm a writer. I love to write. I love to journal. I love to write my thoughts and feelings down before I communicate it to or before I decide to communicate it to anybody. Most of the time, after I write it down, I resolve it on my own. So there's this thing that I like to do. It's called Circle of Awareness. And I learned about this process through studying mindfulness. And basically what it is listing four things. One, your emotions. So if you come across a situation that feels off to you, you point out, okay, so what am I feeling? Am I upset? Am I offended? Am I angry? Am I sad? Am I hurt? The second thing is, what are my impulses to act? Do I want to run away? Do I want to quit my job? Like, do I want to tell on this person? The next thing is tuning into my body sensations and just gaining more self-awareness. Is my heart palpitating? Do I have a headache? Do I feel nauseous? And then finally, the last thing that I write about is just what kind of thoughts am I having? Mm-hmm. And the final thing that I ask myself is, okay, now that I'm aware of what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, what do I need? What is the thing that I think will help me in this particular situation? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the whole process that I go through before I approach somebody. But I also believe that it's always best to approach that person on a one-on-one basis based on my previous experience when I was a teenager. I think it's just so important to approach them with empathy and compassion and just have a conversation.
I love that. And the fact that you can actually go through those steps and put it into your perspective, you are actually able to come to that conversation and start that conversation from a point of empathy and drawing from yourself rather than you did this, you did that, right? You can come and say, listen, what happened yesterday? And when you said this, I felt, right? And you know, you can even talk about the exercise, because I think the more we talk about the different things that help us, not everything's going to help everybody, but people can draw from different things so that they can in turn start doing their own internal work. So I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that that's a great way to, and I think I need to do more of that. But anyways, Shimon, what do you think?
Yeah, I think in my opinion, calling out bias has to and, you know, can be done tactfully, right? By focusing on the behavior rather than attacking the person. This is kind of reinforcing, you know, everything that the three of you said. It could be like using I statements, sharing personal experiences, and kind of framing the conversation around, you know, promoting understanding, I feel can be more effective rather than, you know, like attacking a person, or create a space of, you know, reflection and learning. And this could be just being open-minded, right? Like the fact that you've got to be curious, people come from different upbringings, different experiences. I feel just having the openness to acknowledge that is very, very important. And I guess that's a start. And maybe not exactly answering the question, but, you know, kind of related. I think, Sarah, by you having conversations around these topics is so, so vital in driving a change, right? Like how often do we see conversations around this? But this is so important because I feel I am stimulated in ways by just having conversation with all the other ladies here in certain ways that I wasn't thinking. So yeah, I think that's how we start, I guess.
Ah, gives me goosebumps. So during each one of the blended episodes, I either cry or I get goosebumps. So I got goosebumps today. So we've done what we needed to do. Just kidding. So Margot, last but not least, because I know you've got a handful of action items, and I know we've touched on a few between the four of us.
Yes.
What would you add on to that of how to tackle a situation?
So I want to double down on one point particularly that was made across it, and it's the pre-work, meaning you have to seek on your own to increase awareness, understanding, empathy for others, and the ability to be vulnerable and calling people in, not out. There's a gentleman by the name of Kenji Yoshino, and he talks about a coaching culture versus a cancel culture, and all that has to go into that, that there is a benefit from getting comfortable being uncomfortable, and that is growth. To me, that's pre-work. If you're doing that, if you're leaning into that, if you're learning that, it'll help you in the moments when you need to call out. As was mentioned, this session is great. If your company can engage in enablement, not training, right? So enablement to practice inclusive language and replacement words and things of that nature, it will be super helpful in your ability to know what to say. How to say it and approach it, think about inclusive language. Saying this, not that, is a term that Deloitte uses around their six signature traits of inclusive leader. They talk about being curious and courageous, cognizant, culturally intelligent, being able to make a commitment to others and to ensure that the collaboration is there. Those are the strategies, I would say, that surround it. Measuring results, our pulse survey, it talks about increasing the feeling of belonging, the ability to participate, the trust index and things like that. When you can share that information with people, it helps them to feel equipped to address. When you're addressing, do it very, very calmly, do it very, very empathetically, do it very engaging, showing the outcomes of what's happening in the moment. I could very easily say, oh, you didn't mean that. You meant such and such, right? Or I could very nicely say, oh, that was wonderful what Sarah just indicated. I agree. And here's how I'm expounding on it. So you're actually shortchanging the bias that maybe was happening in the moment to go with a go-to person or to keep giving attention elsewhere. In the moment, you've done nothing wrong. You're just, you know, being an ally. And those sorts of opportunities present themselves and work together. Not putting someone on the defense is the best offense in addressing any sort of bias, whether it's attention, association, and affinity bias, which tends to sometimes, you know, be most prevalent, or if it is something like a workplace proximity. Oh, don't forget about the fact that Latin America has such and such. Now you're being an ally and you're shortchanging a workplace proximity bias. So look for it in your daily operational engagements to very actively and very normally interject an opportunity for an opinion and a way to reverse a bias in action at the moment. Because if you call it as a separate instance, it makes it bigger than it actually needs to be. When you normalize it and make it a part of your talk track regularly, then you can certainly impact it more strategically and sustainably and scalably. You don't have to always have a separate session for it.
Yeah, those are really great points. So going back to my example, so I'm at this breakfast table at the conference and I've got these two senior leaders talking about how they're not going to promote anybody that works from home. What would you suggest in that moment? How, and I don't know these two people, I've only just met them. How would you suggest I could have addressed that?
That's interesting that you would think that being in the office is the only place that you can perform well. Certainly your intellect travels with you both home and in the office. Did you mean that to be 100% in the office, or is that, you know, that they need to at least be there sometime for face value? Like something like around that way, like, oh, wow, I know so-and-so who has really been successful for our company and they've not been in the office 100%. But I can understand your point about wanting to lead by example. I just was curious if you really meant that unequivocally at all, no one who's in office or not in office is worthy of a promotion. So it's almost like you're acting from a place of curiosity. You're smiling and being pleasant with it so that you're showing them that you're not disagreeing, but you're curious and excited and passionate, right? And you almost, to some degree, people, humor kind of binds people together. So if you can, in the moment, show a little humor with the inquisition of them, the inquiry, excuse me, of them, that helps too.
I got some work to do, but I love that. Thank you for sharing that. And I'm glad that we had a like teaching moment, because like if I'm ever in that situation, I do need to be able to call that out. But I really understand what you're saying around, you know, make it like, don't downplay it, but be curious, have fun with it. I think I did a little bit of that, but I've got a little bit more work to do to take it to that extra level to, you know, kind of, you know, talk about that bias.
Something I think that helps also is when you can show them in it. So I will give you an example similar to what you just said that I experienced back to the HBCU conversation. Because I'm head of North American Diversity and Inclusion, I work with our talent attraction team in the hiring. And someone made a comment about only going to Ivy League schools. And it came out right away without me even thinking. I don't know why or how, but it actually helped. I was like, well, you didn't go to Ivy League school and we love you and you're doing just great.
That is amazing.
And he almost died. My heart was racing inside and getting sick to my stomach almost, as was mentioned earlier, as to something that could happen. But it just came out. And he was like, you're right. I went to Penn State and I love my Penn Staters. But he himself didn't realize the bias that he was walking in that moment where he was literally saying, wow. Hey, for this initiative or this program, you know, I want you to look at the Ivy League schools, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So right there in that moment, you know, and I smiled and I kind of joked and it stopped him in his tracks and we all moved on. And then the landscape for that event changed to be more inclusive of other academic institutions.
And one of the, thank you for sharing that example, because I think everybody can learn from that example. But it also, one of the key points that you made there is that you're head of diversity and inclusion. I think you said North America.
Yes.
Even you in that moment. Heart palpitations,
yes,
nervous,
yep.
It came out.
Yep.
So we all, and I want to point that out because I just want everybody to know that you don't have to be perfect in your delivery and that it's never necessarily going to be perfect and you might feel some anxiety and your heart might be racing, but you're not doing anything wrong. And that's also what you said earlier. All right, I want to wrap this up. And how we usually do that is, what's one thing from this conversation that you would hope that the people in the audience will walk away thinking about, taking action on, maybe researching? And if you've got some resources, name some of those resources. So Mary, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, actually a resource that I just discovered the other day. I think her name is Tori Wheeler. She did a podcast about personalization bias. It's very, very interesting, and I think everyone should listen to it. So I think that's a good start.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Margo, what do you think people, what's the one thing people should walk away thinking about or taking action from this conversation?
That we're not perfect. Come from a great place of intent. Speak your truth. Be courageous and make a difference. Be the change you want to see. Mm-hmm. When I think about a resource, there's a book that Kenji Yoshino co-authored, and it's called Say the Right Thing. And it's a book about learning how to be more courageous in this space, being more inclusive and addressing identities and things like that. So the resource is Say the Right Thing. And that book is by Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow. And then,
Love it. Thank you. Shimon.
Yeah, I think, you know, one takeaway that I am actually walking away with is, you know, bias is not necessarily a good or a bad thing. It can be both. Right. And also, I mean, with respect to resources, I think just fostering an open communication, having that community and having the open-mindedness to understand and committing to continuously learn from each other and being curious.
Awesome. Love that. Last but not least, Pooja.
Such an honor to be amongst all of you. So thank you for that. I think I have two things. You know, one is, you know, it's really important to, bias is such a difficult topic. Surrounding yourself with what others see in terms of your actions is an important part of continuing this journey of being, you know, of come, you know, I like the idea of like combating, like not fighting bias, but just combating or figuring out how to work through bias. I think hearing all of you, right, the going first mindset is really important, is how do you create a safe space to talk about it? I think in terms of resources, you know, there's a link here that I'm posting John Allspaugh talks a lot about, you know, these sort of titling or labeling biases, especially in technology. And, you know, if you're close to that, definitely to take a look at the read. It's a really good read.
Awesome. Well, sometimes it can be easy to call people out when we notice their biases or microaggressions, but it can be a whole lot harder to recognize those biases and behaviors within ourselves. And as we work to tackle bias and promote equity, working on ourselves is just as important as developing strategies to tackle bias in others. We need to acknowledge that none of us is perfect and work on educating ourselves to do better. Let's allow others to challenge us in a safe and productive way and be open to feedback. Let's embrace diverse perspectives because ultimately, this isn't about putting people on blast or getting people canceled for making mistakes. It's about correcting age-old biases and stereotypes and building an equal and thriving future for all of us. Remember, you can reach out to me or any of the guests on social media if you have anything you'd like to add to what we've talked about today. And remember to join us next month where we'll be talking about allyship. Allyship is so important to the success of all underrepresented groups at work and in the community, but sometimes allies are conspicuously missing from difficult conversations. Why is that? Well, allyship comes with sacrifice, a risk that many aren't willing to take. So join us to dive into the true cost of allyship, but why that cost is oh so worth it. I'll see you then. Thank you so much to Shimon, Pooja, Margot, and Mary. Thank you so much for having the courage and being brave and sharing vulnerably and authentic today with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks, everybody.